And we continue with our American stories. More people have ventured into outer space than have been to where the Titanic rests, 2.5 miles down on the ocean floor. Lowell Lytle has been one of the privileged few who has seen the Titanic firsthand. Lowell has played the part of Captain Smith at Titanic events all over the globe and has been entertaining guests at the Titanic Museum for more than 15 years. Here's Lowell Lytle to tell his story and the story of the Titanic's last hero.
How do you do? This is Lowell Lytle. I have an unusual story to tell you. I was home minding my own business way back in 1987. I heard about the Titanic. They've discovered it. And wouldn't you know, I got a phone call from the designer that was building an exhibit Orlando on the Titanic. He called me, he said, Lowell, we've gone through 350 actors here in Orlando, can't find a captain. He said, I told these men I know someone that can play that part. He's my next door neighbor. I used to be a lead singer in one of my rock and roll bands. I had 8 bands for 22 years touring the United States and Canada. And I went over there on a hoot just to see what it was all about. And he opened the door and there were 6 men sitting around the table. And he said, gentlemen, here's Captain Smith. They took one look at me and they said, yep, you're it. I didn't know what the captain looked like, but an hour later I went through that souvenir shop and I saw the front page of the New York Times, 1912. Picture of Captain Smith looking right at me. And my first thought was my neighbor has taken my picture and pasted it on the front page of the New York Times. He shouldn't do that, that's wrong. Well, I was there for about 2 years. And then I heard they were going to dive to the Titanic, and I thought, oh, that would be nice if I could do that. So I called them, and they said, no. I waited 2 weeks, and I called them again, and I said, I'd like to go down to the Titanic. And they said, no, no, that's for archaeologists and important people, wealthy people. People have climbed Mount Everest, millionaires. I waited 2 more weeks and I remember Winston Churchill made a famous speech during World War II. He said, we will fight them in the air, we will fight them on land, we will fight them at sea, but we will never surrender. I remember that he was invited to speak at Harvard University after the war. And the professor said to the students, get your pads and pens ready, because when this man speaks, it's wisdom. They flew him over from England. The old man hobbled up to the microphone and he said, never give up. Never, 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 never give up. And he turned around and sat down. I never forgot that. That was the best speech I ever heard. I called him again, and I said, I'm the captain of the Titanic. I'm in front of the camera. I'm in everyone's home. I'm the one that's talking about your exhibit. I believe if the media could say this man's been down to see this ship, more people would be interested in what I have to say about it, and you'll get more people there and you'll make more money. It got quiet on the other end of the phone, and the man said, I think you're right, come along. So I actually packed up and I went to St. John's, Newfoundland. That's where you leave from. And I got there and they looked at me and they said, you're too tall, you won't fit in there. I said, I'll fit in there. Now, I'm 6'4". I'm the tallest and the oldest that's ever been down to the Titanic. I was 68 at the time. I said, I'll fit in there. Well, we don't have a fire suit big enough for you. Fire suit? What's this about a fire? Well, you'll be breathing 100% oxygen. It could flash to a fire like Apollo 1 did. Well, if that's the case, I'll be burnt to a crisp in 10 seconds. What good is a suit? They said, well, your name will be written on it. It's for identification. Identification? I'm that tall guy down there. Well, anyway, I got in the suit. The suit was a little too small, but I did get in one. Now, when I got on the Akademi Kelch, that Russian dive vessel, I noticed on the back end of one of those subs, the protective shield that went around the propeller was held together with duct tape. Now, that doesn't breed a lot of confidence. And I'm thinking to myself, do I really want to do this? All I could think of is, well, I've lived a long life. I'm 68. If I die, I know where I'm going. That's the important thing. And if I come back, I'll have a story to tell. And I came back, and I've been telling that story for 21 years all around the world. I told it in Shanghai, China for 2 weeks. I told it in Singapore for 2 weeks. I've been in every state in the United States, every province in Canada where they've had these Titanic exhibits. Sometimes two or three times, different cities. One day, I was eating dinner. Now, there's twice as many people out there that would like to go down that would get a chance. So I knew I didn't have any chance. But while I was eating, that fellow that I talked to on the phone came over to me, bent over, and said to me, Lowell, you're going down in the morning.
And what a unique and original voice we're listening to. And that is, of course, the voice of Lowell Lytle, who plays the part and has been playing the part of Captain Smith. When we come back, more of Lowell Lytle's story here on Our American Stories. Folks, if you love the great American stories we tell and love America like we do, we're asking you to become a part of the Our American Stories family. If you agree that America is a good and great country, please make a donation. A monthly gift of $17.76 is fast becoming a favorite option for supporters. Go to OurAmericanStories.com now and go to the Donate button and help us keep the great American stories coming. That's OurAmericanStories.com. And we continue with Our American Stories and with Lowell Lytle's story about being one of the privileged few who's seen the Titanic firsthand, and who also happens to play the part of Captain Smith at Titanic events all over the globe. Let's return to Lowell Lytle and his story.
Oh my goodness, my heart began to pound. I couldn't believe it. They're gonna let me go down to the Titanic. Well, Fox Television followed me all around like I was an astronaut. Now first of all, you gotta take your shoes off. In the event that you pick up any oil from that mothership walking on the deck and breathing 100% oxygen, it could, if there's a spark, that would be it. So I took my shoes off, I got inside, and with my long legs, wouldn't you know, I kicked over the oxygen tank. Boy, it didn't take long before that Russian pilot came alive and straightened that thing out. Now, I got no place to sit. I'm in a ball and 6.5 feet in diameter, 19 inches thick, and there's 3 grown men in there. And it takes 2.5 hours to get down 2.5 miles to the wreck site. They turn off all the lights to conserve the batteries. Now they turned that hatch down tight, and I knew then I couldn't change my mind. I can't see anything. All I can do is think about what I'm about to see. I'm not going to see a movie, I'm going to see the real thing. And when they turned on the lights, the Russian pilot says, we're almost there. And I didn't like what I saw. We were going too fast, and we bounced off the ocean floor. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Of course, it took 5 minutes for all that dust to settle down. And the first thing that I noticed was the sea life. It was so strange. There's no light that far down on the ocean floor, no sun. So the crabs are white, the starfish that 13 inches in diameter, 5 points, but none of them any larger than your little finger. Now, when they turned on the lights, moments later, I was right over the bow, the same spot where Jack in the movie held out his arms and said, I'm the king of the world. I went right over that spot. I said, take me to the captain's cabin. James Cameron said the side was already gone. They took me there. I was 5 feet from the captain's bathtub for 10 minutes while they were changing film. I found a wrench down there. The mouth on it was 13 inches across, sticking straight up in the ocean floor like somebody had thrown a javelin. And I noticed while I was picking items up off the ocean floor, there was a hat. It looked like a derby hat. And it was in mint condition. There's no current that far down. And I told the Russian pilot to go get that, and he did. There's two mechanical arms on the outside of that sub. And he picked it up and they pushed a button and a basket went out from underneath. And he let go of it to fall into the basket and it disappeared like a cloud. The microorganisms are eating up that ship at such a tremendous rate. It's gonna be an orange spot on the ocean floor within 100 years. Now I think that hat was probably made out of felt. Had it been made out of leather, it probably could make it, because those microorganisms that do not like the tanning process of leather, it repels them. Their shoes and hats and bags, that's why you see those things. Found enough items and I thought to myself, I'm just gonna stay focused on this and not get involved emotionally. But after an hour and a half, all I could think of was what really took place that night. 1,500 souls slipped into eternity. All of them had plans to get to New York and start a new life. It never happened. Life can be short, folks. Make sure you tell your loved one every day how much you love them. And you better know where you're going, because it's going to happen to every one of us. We're all going to die one time or another. When it happens, it'll be too soon. Just remember this. Eternity is a long time to be wrong. Get it right. In fact, there's a story about a second class passenger. His name is Reverend John Harper. There's a book entitled The Titanic's Last Hero. It's about Reverend Harper. And he was on his way to Chicago to preach. He had a revival service before he left. And he told the people in that service, he said he was going to go to New York on that new ship called the Titanic the next week. After the service, one of his parishioners came up to him and said, Reverend, I have a bad feeling about that ship. I have an ominous feeling that something bad's gonna take place. I feel so strongly about it. I want you to go to New York, but I don't want you to get on the ship. Please take the Lusitania. I'll even pay for your ticket. Reverend Harper thought about it. He says, no, the Apostle Paul wouldn't run away from danger. If anything happens, he says, I'm ready. And it happened. And when the Titanic started to go down, that Baptist minister ran around the deck shouting, women and children and unsaved people, get aboard the lifeboats. You just can't keep these Baptists quiet. He even gave his life vest to a man that was not a Christian. His daughter Anna was standing right next to him. And his sister-in-law was standing next to him. They both survived. The sister-in-law overheard the reverend when he gave that life vest to that man. He said, "Here, take this. I don't need it. I'm not going down. I'm going up." He's in the water now, 28 degrees. It feels like 1,000 knives stabbing him. And a man drifted by on a piece of wood, and Reverend Harper shouted to the man, "Are you saved?" The man said, "No." Reverend Harper shouted, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved." The man drifted off into the dark, and later the current drew him back. And Reverend Harper again shouted to the man, "Are you saved yet?" The man said, "I can't honestly say that I am." Reverend Harper's last words were, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and thou shalt be saved." And with that, the reverend slipped under the water and went to that frozen, watery grave. There were 12 people pulled from the water that night. 6 of them lived. That man was one of them. And that story was told a few weeks later in Hamilton, Ontario, by that same man who said, "I listened to Reverend Harper's last message and became a believer in Jesus Christ with 2 miles of water beneath me." Titanic's last hero, Reverend John Harper. God bless you, folks.
And what a piece of storytelling by Lowell Lytle. Not only his story, not only his passion for the Titanic, but telling the story of the Titanic's last hero as well, as perhaps only he can do. We haven't had many better storytellers on this show, and many better stories. A special thanks to Lowell Lytle for sharing his story. He has been entertaining guests at the Titanic Museum for more than 15 years. He is also the author of the inspiring read, Diving into the Deep. Lowell Lytle's story, the story of the Titanic, here on Our American Stories. And we continue with Our American Stories. For the past 5 years, Reader's Digest has been searching across America for places that have great stories about nice people. They call these towns the nicest places in America. We've partnered with Reader's Digest to bring their storytellers to our listeners, to you. Today's story is on Life Moves Yoga, a yoga studio near Texas's Fort Hood that's been helping our tough military men and women find their way. Here's our own Monty Montgomery with the story.
For as long as she can remember, Beth Funk has always been surrounded by our armed forces.
I am a child of the military, so my dad was active duty military for 33 years. I moved all around my whole life. Actually went to 10 schools by the time I graduated from high school. So we had a very mobile and wonderful life. And right after I graduated from college and at the University of Texas, I married my husband, Paul, and he is an active duty service member. So really, I have spent my entire life within the military community, and actually only spent 2 weeks in between the time I graduated from college and the time I got married. So I would say that's the only 2 weeks of my life where I haven't had been a military dependent or had a military ID card. I really wish I could say that I had gotten started with a yoga practice much earlier in my life, but it really was a very bad back injury that got me started on the path of yoga. I really couldn't do the things that I was doing prior to my back injury. I couldn't run anymore, I couldn't cycle anymore, and it really sidelined me from everything in my life and in my world. And my daughter at the time was interested in getting started with the yoga practice, and I had read a lot about the benefits, really the healing benefits of yoga, but I didn't know anything about it. But I decided I really didn't have anything to lose, and it would be something fun that we could do together. Within about 3 weeks of our practicing, I realized that my back was beginning to heal. And so we embarked on that journey together and both really discovered way more than we thought that we would.
And one of the things Beth discovered was that she wanted to teach yoga to others.
If you asked me, you know, 5-6 years ago about this, I would have thought it was just the craziest idea in the world. I had no intention of really doing this. I had no interest whatsoever in becoming a yoga teacher, none. But through the process of learning more about it and throughout the training, I just realized that I couldn't keep it to myself. We were living in Washington, D.C. at the time and discovered that we were getting ready to move to Texas. And I knew that I wanted to continue to teach, and I wanted to continue to be able to impact as many people as possible. And this crazy idea came to me that the best way to do it would be to have a physical space, brick and mortar, if you will, you know, a physical space for people to come in and to experience this thing that had been such a powerful tool in my own life and really in our daughter's life as well. And so really took us going out on a leap of faith, because we really didn't know how long we would be in Texas. We knew that we would have most likely another move on the horizon, and this was not a permanent assignment for us. So it didn't really make a lot of sense from the business perspective. However, our sense of mission and purpose was so strong that we decided that the potential for impact was so great that we would take the risk, and we did it. And we opened up our physical space February 15th of 2017. When we first opened in 2017, we positioned our studio very close to the military post. And so we, as you can imagine, have a large percentage of our population that's military affiliated.
But what could our military men and women find in Beth's mecca of peace and mindfulness? It turns out, a lot. But you have to know what yoga is to understand why.
I think that most people, when they hear the word yoga, what they think of is, you know, tying yourself up like a pretzel into crazy positions. Yoga is about way more than that. It's about breathing and moving and concentrating and focusing and really uniting all of the different pieces of yourself so that you can be at peace. And you can, we describe it as really like a coming back to home or coming back to home base. And we're talking about physical health, mental health, spiritual wellness, all of those things. You know, we knew that this could have a tremendous impact. We had an active duty service member who practiced with us. This amazing, amazing hero had been very seriously wounded during a deployment, and he practiced with his prosthetic on his leg. And he described himself as, you know, he's a soldier, he doesn't like sitting still, and he talked about how yoga gives him something to do, but it helps him calm his mind at the same time. And so that was a really important experience for all of us to go on that journey with him.
The studio also caters to the loved ones of our military, which has created a yoga family that truly matters to Beth and has resulted in powerful moments in her life.
So we have military spouses who are really, you know, serving alongside of their service members. And this practice and having sort of a safe space to come into the practice has been really powerful. We had a young military spouse who started practicing with us, and she became so involved in the practice and enjoyed it so much that she decided to do our yoga teacher training, became a yoga teacher, and then sadly and in a heartbreaking way, we lost her this last year. She passed away unexpectedly, really hard on our yoga family. From that, her dearest childhood friend started coming to our practice space just to really honor what was so important to this beautiful yogi. Started practicing in our space, felt connected to her in that space, and also became connected to the practice. And now this friend is enrolled in yoga teacher training to become a yoga teacher so that she can spread the love and spread the light. And so it's really stories like that that just fill us up from the inside out and just keep us motivated to show up every day. And at the end of the day, this is all about the people that step foot in our space every day. And this is very, very important to us.
And a great job by Monty on the production of that piece. And a special thanks again to the folks at Reader's Digest. Beth Funk, 10 schools she went to growing up. What's known in military parlance as a military brat. But this is a part of American life. Beth Funk's story, her Texas yoga studio near Fort Hood in Texas, helping our warriors find some peace here on Our American Story. And we continue with Our American Stories. And up next, a story from one of our listeners and now regular contributors, Paul Bauer from Minneapolis, Minnesota, who listens out of our great affiliate, WCCO 830. Today, Paul brings us a story he's titled, Lessons from Gizmo.
When I became an empty nester and my home became quiet and lonely, I decided it might be time to get a pet. I knew nothing about dogs, but there must be a reason why they're called man's best friend, so I went for it. Without a clue on how to go about picking the right precious canine, and very few brains in my head, I went with my ear, and I chose the sweetest sounding breed I could find. I purchased a King Charles Cavalier Spaniel. With a royal name like that, how could I lose? This regal sounding dog was going to be my ticket out of middle class. And, like the young Prince William of England, I would ascend straight into royalty. I'm not so sure that was a good plan, looking back. I'm now 5 years into this canine experiment, and though I have a breed that starts with the word King Charles and ends with the word Cavalier, I have yet to meet Queen Elizabeth, or even sit next to Bob Uecker at a baseball game, for that matter.
Good seat, sir.
You're in the wrong seat, buddy. Come on.
Oh, I must be in the front row.
Come on.
But Gizmo, the princely dog, has managed to teach me a few things. I've compiled a list of the top 10 things I've learned from this furry creature. Number 1 is humility. There's very little pride in owning a dog, especially when you have to do sanitation duty. Do you like holding those bags, swinging them by your knees while on your hike? Furthermore, while walking your dog, what's the proper way to introduce yourself to a passing stranger or a friendly neighbor when you have a baggie in one hand and a leash in the other? Try saying, "Pardon the poop," without being humble. It's very sad. Number 2, you have to learn who is boss. Are you short on long suffering? Then get a dog, like me. And that canine character builder will teach you who's boss in no time. Take, for example, the game of fetch. I thought all dogs played that throw and retrieve interactive practice. So when I first bought my dog, I looked forward to spending hours and hours of quality time with me throwing balls and my happy pooch bringing them back, over and over, back and forth. All for naught. My dog has no interest in that kind of bonding nonsense. When I throw the ball, she pouts and breathes and looks me in the eye, glancing up at my arching eyebrows as if to say, "Too much work, sir. Sorry, I can't help." Maybe that is where the King Charles part comes in. My dog, Gizmo, she'd rather be waited on than returning fetches thrown by me, her master. My failure at teaching her these basic animal instincts is not for lack of trying. I've tried just about every kind of object possible. A stick, a rope, tennis ball, golf ball, racquetball, fuzzy balls, and super balls. It doesn't matter. All of them are losers. I throw them out as far or short as possible, and with hope, I say, "Fetch!" But the reaction is the same. A stare down. Not even a twitch of a muscle or hint that maybe she should go chase that ball. I end up retrieving it myself, and I can plainly see a smirk on Gizmo's face as she observes this routine. I even tried what I thought was pure genius, cutting a hole in a tennis ball and filling it with treats. That one actually brought minor success. We got halfway there. She did chase it down, but there was no way she was bringing that ball back to me. It was a closed deal. Negotiations were off. She ate the treat on the spot, and of course, left the ball there for me to fetch. My patience is really being tested, but after 5 years of trying, I have not given up. Number 3, I've learned my diet is not so bad after all. First, let me try saying something with a straight face. I do not have an eating disorder. There, I said it. Only problem is, it's all a lie. Now in my late 50s, I have matured and gotten real about life. And I've learned that carrying a few extra inches around my waist is time I get used to the idea. I'm never going to be ultra slim again. And I do have an eating problem. I admit it. But at least I'm not as bad as Gizmo. That dog will eat anything that resembles food, even some things that don't. Grass, dirt, roadkill, it doesn't matter. It's all food to her. As for human food, no matter how sneaky I am, she knows when I have food, and when pressed, I will hand it over, and she will gobble it down in seconds flat with no manners to boot. So I've come to realize I have problems with eating, but I'm a model of self-discipline compared to that dog. Number 4, you're never really alone. You don't need sunshine to cast a shadow, I have learned. This dog will not leave me out of her sight. Even the bathroom is not safe. If not for the door, she would be right there wondering why I'm in there, sitting on that thing with my pants down to my ankles. As it is, she's relegated to scratching at the door, telling me to go hurry up and finish my business. Number 5, I'm not that smart. If there's anything I have become convinced of since buying Gizmo, it's this. I'm being outsmarted by a dog. She is my superior. The dog is the one in charge, not me, so I better get used to that fact. We walk when she wants to walk. We go where she wants to go. If I feel like stepping it up and making it into a jog, it's no guarantee she will jog with me. Gizmo jog when she feels like it, which is almost never. So I might as well follow my leader and obey her instincts. Kind of like the old Hanna-Barbera cartoon character, Quick Draw McGraw, Gizmo says, in essence, "I'll do the thinning around here, Bubba boy." She even orders food for us both. When I'm out cooking on the grill, I know why she wags her tail and watches me intently. She is not happy to see me. She's only making sure I cook the steak just right. Medium rare, I have learned. She has me feeling too guilty to give her a piece with some fat and grizzle on it. She might get sick, I think to myself. So, of course, she gets the center cut, leaving me to eat the part that's not fit for a dog. Number 6, I'm a lousy barber. My dog has also taught me something about personal care. I'm now her personal hairstylist. I'm too cheap to pay for a groomer. I don't even pay to have someone give my own haircut. I'm not about to pay someone to do my dog, so Gizmo is at the mercy of my scissors. If she's not going to play fetch, I'm not going to go to beauty school. Her precious fur coat looks as though it had a run-in with a weed whacker and lost. Luckily for her, I was told you can't shave a King Charles Cavalier Spaniel. It just doesn't work. But if it did, the regal Gizmo would have a look just like my personal favorite, the Michael Jordan Kirby Puckett Chrome Dome. A dog dude made to look just like me. But as it is, she's the only dog in the neighborhood with a mullet. Number 7, if you snooze, you don't always lose. I'm not lazy, not when compared to Gizmo at least. I no longer have to feel guilty taking a 10-minute nap in the afternoon. When this dog is not eating, following me around, or refusing to play fetch, or complaining about her mullet, she's sleeping, period. She believes in the power nap strategy for success, like Einstein, so I follow her example. Number 8, you don't have to fuss about housework. Our house used to be spotless before Gizmo. We were the model of good housekeeping. But all thoughts about our house being perfect, or even any guilt about leaving the living room just a little bit messy, that has completely vanished. Gizmo gave us perspective. From the beginning of this experiment, the shedding beast has turned our house into one continuous fuzzball, not a house of impeccable perfection. We have worn out 3 vacuum cleaners, and still cannot keep the place fuzz-free. I think Mr. Hoover invented the notion that every home needs a pet. Number 9, it's better to stick to a routine. I used to love change. Variety, that's the spice of life, right? But now in my middle-aged years, living with my King Charles Cavalier Spaniel, I've changed my mind. You mess with your routine and you pay for it the following day. Gizmo reinforces that notion. Don't even think about sitting down to unwind after a hard day at the office. The dog must be walked first. Try putting your feet up for a few minutes, and she will stare you down with a look that could kill a squirrel. This is Gizmo's time, and you better get up off your booty and take her out for a walk, so that she can come home afterwards and sleep. Number 10, doctors are overrated. For anyone considering the medical profession, you might want to forget about brain surgery or heart transplants and go right to the more lucrative position of veterinarian. I've never paid for one of those other surgeries, but I can't imagine they're more expensive than Gizmo's yearly checkup at the vet and her corresponding medications. Gizmo has me trained. Animal science and canine medicine, that's where it's at. There's a gold mine there. With all this wisdom I've acquired from dog ownership and all these lessons learned from life with Gizmo in an empty nest, I have to wonder, how did I learn anything in life without a dog? That pooch has changed my life. Too much. Way too much. She has taken over. I have become my dog's intern, stylist, psychiatrist, personal attendant, provider, and student. Maybe I shouldn't be such a pushover, and I should consider teaching this old dog a few new tricks. But I'm too prone to roll over at this stage in my life. That's just the way it goes. She's the dog, I am the tail. It is, after all, a dog's life, isn't it?
And great work, as always, by Greg Hengler on this piece. And a special thanks to Paul Bauer from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's a devoted listener and also a great contributor and listens on our great affiliate WCCO 830. By the way, I have pugs, and anyone who has pugs understands and empathizes with my friend Paul. My goodness, King Charles Cavalier Spaniels and pugs have a lot in common. They run the show, period. The story of Gizmo and lessons from Gizmo here on Our American Stories.